morning.
May it please the court, my name is Robert Loeb from the Department of Justice, and I represent the United States in this matter. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal. The district court's grant of the habeas petition here should be reversed and the matter remanded to the district court for it to properly assess and account for the evidence. Reversal is required because the district court made two interrelated errors in its approach to the evidence in this case. First, the district court failed to adequately account for false cover stories from the petitioner. This court just last week in the Uthman case reaffirmed that such false cover stories can indeed be strong evidence in support of detention. Second, the district court failed
That's somewhat analogous to the way we treat pretext under Title VII. For instance, in the en banc case in ACCA, we have made clear that an employer's response to a claim of discrimination can itself be regarded as powerful evidence of discrimination if it is perceived as a pretext. So you're drawing an analogy to that.
Correct, Your Honor, and this court has drawn the analogy to the criminal cases where coming up with a false cover story to have an exculpatory cover story, which is turned to be either incredible or false, can be strong evidence even in a criminal case to support a conviction. The second error is the district court failed to adequately look at the evidence together, including the false cover stories, and failed to look at the mutually reinforcing nature of that evidence. As to the
Are you challenging a fact-finding there? You say you're not. You say you're not challenging the district court's fact-finding, but aren't you coming very close to challenging
it? We are certainly saying, writ large and as to some specific facts, the district court applied the wrong approach. So, yes, we're looking at the general approach, and we're looking to some specific things regarding the district court's finding. And we can go through that. The district court, for example, in the SIRs the district court dismissed, the district court never gives a basis for dismissing the Al-Jadani's report from Al-Qadi that there were these two bin Laden-funded Tehran Al-Qaeda guest houses. So that is a critical fact which sets a predicate for the government's narrative in this case, that we have these bin Laden-funded guest houses in Tehran. The district court basically and the petitioners here just dismiss that, saying, well, that information we got from...
Stop for a moment. Run through specifically the facts that you have put in evidence which you think establish at least a prima facie case. And what are they? They are, number one, the guest house, right?
We have the establishment of these two bin Laden-funded guest houses being run by the Al-Qaeda, a high-level Al-Qaeda operative. We have the fact that in Mashhad, which is to the east, we have a way station there which is used to take people from this Al-Qaeda guest house as they're moving to and from Afghanistan to and from the fight.
You have the money. You have the money.
We have that he is captured with, in his own testimony, at least $2,000. At one point he said he has $2,491. And he has no credible explanation for that money. It does, however, fit completely the narrative that he is operating as a Al-Qaeda facilitator. We can run through, it's not just that he claims he left Yemen with between $1,500 and $2,000 under his own various statements. But then as his own statements catalog expense after expense after expense during that trip. He bribes the embassy official to get his visa. He buys a plane ticket to Pakistan. He spends 4 days Karachi touring around. He buys a train ticket to Lahore. He has a taxi to the JT Center. He stays at the JT Center for two and a half months and says he has to buy his food during that time. He says he has to pay Ali $1,500. They pay for a train to Iran. They bribe officials, expense after expense after expense, and yet he is caught with more money than when he left. The district court says, well, that's just not helpful to me in analyzing this case. Well, Usman and Al-Adahi, the fact that he's telling a false cover story is, of course, important, but it's also that the information that he is carrying the money fits exactly with the narrative of somebody who is working with Al-Qaeda at the Tehran guest house, helping people, facilitating their movements to Mashhad. And that person, we have expert declarations explaining that person.
I have to be careful now in terms of getting into anything that's classified, but we have also his conversations with
Al-Jadani.
Yes.
And that's the strong evidence. So this is evidence that Al-Jadani, who was found to be a reliable source by the government, spoke with the petitioner at Guantanamo. He admitted to Al-Jadani that he was at these guest houses in Tehran, and that there were two guest houses, and fitting all these things together.
Would it be error for the district court to exclude the Al-Jadani statements then?
The reasons he gave, certainly. There's no basis here for the reasons.
Is there any reason that you can envision for excluding those statements?
I don't think so, Your Honor, but the fact is that the reason...
You're challenging a factual determination there, too.
But if he looks at all the facts together...
No. You're challenging a factual determination.
Yeah, we believe that fact information is flawed. Absolutely, Your Honor. Our briefs are very clear about that.
Well, you're not so clear about that.
But we think it's because he didn't look at the evidence together and that his approach...
You don't have to look. I think what my colleague is pointing out is that evidence is probative by itself. You don't have to look with anything else.
Right. I think as a fact finder, the district court would have to look at what else evidence there is about Al-Jadani and make a fact. I don't think there is other things in the record which would make him incredible or give a reason for doubting it. But again, the district court does have a fact-finding role here. We're asking that the court remand this to the district court to approach the case as required by Al-Adai, as required by
it seems Usman. Like you want us to remand with a direction to find Al-Jadani's statements credible and part of the record.
Unless there's a legitimate basis for doing so, other way. Absolutely, Your Honor. We could say, look, the only reason you gave, he gives, is it's not entirely certain. So, of course, certainty is not the standard, that the person that Jadani spoke to was the petitioner here. Of course, he was the only Hussein al-Adani at Guantanamo. So the fact that he's calling him Hussein, and he doesn't dispute that he's Hussein from the city of Aden, Yemen. He doesn't dispute that all the things that he told Al-Jadani are in fact true, that he was in Tehran, was in Mashhad. All these things match up to the Jadani's statements. Also, Jadani, the facts he provides, he describes from this Hussein al-Adani the facts of his capture. It would be just incredible to think that he's just coming up with these facts out of there, which just happen to match the exact reality of petitioner's story. There's the fact of the travel to Mashhad. The district court
says it's puzzling, but he went in the wrong direction.
He says it's perplexing. Of course, it's not perplexing if he is in fact not telling the truth about it, and he is acting as a facilitator. The district court finds it strange and unexplained that he spends 2.5 months with the JT group, which is known to support and provide cover for Al Qaeda and other terrorist groups. Of course, it's not unexplained. Petitioner here tried to explain that again and again. The district court just didn't believe in his explanation. Well, the district court needs to give weight to the fact that he's telling an incredible story. He told it, he had an explanation. The district court rejected it and said it's strange and unexplained. The district court needs, and it's on remand, to factor that in under Uthman and al-Adahi.
We are operating under a standard of preponderance of evidence. You have pointed out 6 or 7, if I count correctly, pieces of evidence upon which you rely. Is that correct?
We have at least 7 different intelligence reports we rely on. We rely on his own statement.
I'm talking about pieces of evidence.
Right.
So you have 7 pieces of evidence upon which you rely. They are all, in your judgment, pieces of probative evidence.
They're mutually reinforcing pieces.
Well, but whether they're mutually reinforcing or not, I want to establish they're all probative pieces of probative evidence.
Absolutely.
Is correct? Against that, what has the petitioner shown as evidence?
Well, the petitioner, of course, has his own statement, his own contra story.
Is that the only piece of evidence that the petitioner has?
He has tried to poke holes at different aspects.
No, I'm not asking whether... That's a separate question, whether your evidence is probative or not.
Right.
But is there any evidence that the petitioner has presented besides his story?
I don't believe so. You could ask them, but I think that's...
All right, I just wanted to hear it. But if, in fact, you produce 7 pieces of evidence that are probative, and the petitioner produces only a story which is perceived to be non-believable, then, in fact, this is an easy case because there's not even a question of weighing preponderance of evidence. There's virtually no evidence on behalf of the petitioner.
As we said in our brief, we think we have a strong case here in support of detention.
I've been thinking a lot about this notion of preponderance of evidence, because sometimes it seems courts have been using preponderance of evidence as almost as if it was really a standard of beyond a reasonable doubt.
Well, for example,
in a civil case, all we have to do, we ask is whether a party with a burden, which is you, produces evidence. Well, all right, there's seven pieces of evidence. We look to the other side, and we have only one piece of evidence, besides an attempted attack on yours, which we can get to, but one piece of evidence, which is a story which you argue is wholly incredible. So you would have this as a case, you would argue this is a case where you have seven pieces of evidence and the petitioner has zero.
And the fact
In fact, the petitioner's evidence is actually evidence on your side because it's an incredible story. So that would be 8-0.
I'm not going to disagree with you, Your Honor. We think that the district
I think we've sometimes thought about this as in an artificial way.
Well, for example, when the district court's examining whether what Jadani heard from Elmer Fetty himself could be credited, so why can't be entirely certain that it was him? Like you said, under preponderance, we're not looking for certainty. We're looking for more likely than not.
Right. And certainly, each of your pieces of evidence has to be probative. That is to say, it has to show more likely than not evidence that would inculpate.
When looked at together, Your Honor, right. Even if each individual case.
That's true, but I'm not even sure you need the having to look in together, although, of course, that's a major argument. But go ahead.
Instead, the district court looked at particular flaws and particular pieces of evidence, an IIR which has an incorrect date, when the SIR, which it's based on, has the correct date. Dismiss the Al-Jadani statements about
the district court said it was looking at everything in the totality, which is what the district court was required to do. In other words, I'm not sure your complaint about its at least stated approach is correct necessarily. I understand your argument about specific pieces of the analysis, but in terms of the framework the district court applied.
Well, the district court also cited the El-Adahi district court opinion and specifically said that, at least said something in its opinion, which gave doubt that if it found
that's really picking one sentence out of the opinion, I think, though. The district court said it was looking at it all together.
It did say that, and of course Judge Kessler said that in El-Adahi as well. And what we have to look at is what the judge is actually doing in the case. Mm-hmm. And we have where the district court is dismissing all these Al-Qaeda statements about the bin Laden guest house simply because that those particular statements didn't tie petitioner there.
But what's the remand supposed to look like here that you're asking for? So normally when we remand, we ask the district court there was some issue. In other words, if the district court had said, I'm going to look at each piece of evidence in isolation, okay, we could reverse and remand for the district court to look at the evidence as a totality. But the district court already did that. So what are we going to say, under your view, if you want us to remand?
I mean, I would think, and I wouldn't fight the fact that if the court believes that it requires outright reversal, we wouldn't fight that, of course. But we would.
Well, I'm just getting to the point. The district court might naturally say, "I did." If we did what you say, which is vacate, reverse, and remand to apply the totality of the evidence test that we've articulated, the district court might say that's what I did.
Well, I think you could start by saying, look, under Uthman and Al-Adahi, you need to account for the false cover stories here. You found, you know, these at least three facts to be incredible or unexplained when he had explanations for them. He has the money, which the district court never made a finding about because he didn't find it helpful. That's something you can't do. You need to address that. And if there's a reason you think that a petitioner is telling the truth, you need to document that and find so. But as we look at the record, I'm sorry, Judge Roger.
Go ahead. Finish.
As we look at the record, the government makes a substantial case that, in fact, the fact that he's caught with money is substantially incriminating. So you need to address that and to factor that in together with the other evidence. So what he didn't do, you say he looked at the totality, but obviously he didn't factor those things into the totality. He didn't factor in the fact that we had these Al-Qaeda guest house there. If he has a reason for, he said, well, I don't need to made a particular finding about that, but we have statements from Al-Ghadi to Al-Jadani, which there's no explanation for his opinion about why he's not finding that to be credible or true.
All right, so In your reply brief, you argue that what the error by the district court was, taking as true what Judge Kavanaugh has just said about the district court's statement, is, according to your reply brief, he failed to compare the government's evidence to what the petitioner was challenging to determine which was the more likely.
Well, I don't recall we said that particularly, but we certainly we're looking at, we always have the burden of proof to get to convince the judge by a preponderance that he is detainable under the AUMF.
Here's what you said in your reply brief. The district court failed to weigh the government's version of events against petitioner's implausible discovery cover story, which is a misapplication of the preponderance of evidence standard. That's at page 5.
Right, so in weighing our evidence, it had to take into account also the false cover stories and how the false cover stories actually support, and the fact that he's lying about it supports this, but also the fact that he's going to Mashhad supports it.
So now, the district court says, and he goes through this evidence, and he says, not only at the end, he says, well, looking at this alone or in conjunction with other evidence, the government hasn't met its burden of proof. And then he says, right after he says, I looked at all the evidence and I'm, you know, willing to look at all of it as reinforcing, but I need further corroboration. And then he goes through the Al-Jadani statements, which you and Judge Silverman have discussed as, you know, six different pieces, but the district court says it's all from the same source, the same translator. So there's only one source there.
Well,
I mean, this is the district court's analysis of the evidence, and that's why I think, isn't Judge Silverman's question at the beginning key, that this is really a challenge to fact-finding?
Well, we are certainly challenging certain facts, is that the reasons he gave for rejecting them just are not supported by the rationale he gave, or we think by the record, but it doesn't, and that the district court needs to re-examine them together with the false cover stories on remand here.
When he says that this is perplexing with regard to the Mashhad.
Right,
he has to factor that in. He can't just stop there.
And examine how it's that fits in the narrative. We have evidence, which is unrebutted here, from a high-level al-Qaeda person speaking to al-Jadani. The district court never gives any reason for doubting that. Is how we have the guest house here. We have Mashhad.
He gives two reasons, doesn't he? He says there's this identification question that you've already discussed.
Right.
And then he also talks about, well, the evidence, other evidence is sort of jailhouse gossip.
Right, so, but none of that have to do, so Jadani's, when he's relating information, he's doing it from three different sources. One, he says, I had direct relationship in Afghanistan with al-Ghadi, a high-level person. This is another person that the al-Bahani, who was also in Tehran guest house, also knew al-Ghadi.
But I thought al-Ghadi never put.
But al-Ghadi establishes that there are bin Laden Tehran guest house.
Right. But I mean, there are lots of hotels in this town too, but I haven't stayed at any of them. No. And that's what the district court.
Right, but the district court you look at the opinion, never factors in fact says, well, I don't even know that there's guest house in Tehran, or that there.
That's not the key issue.
If he is at a bin Laden funded guest house and staying there.
That's the question.
Right, and then we have, all right, so but that's an important, I think that's the important foundation we're resting our case on, Your Honor. And
what?
The district court doesn't, the district court basically doesn't acknowledge the al-Ghadi information. And then we have that.
Am I correct, counsel, that the al-Ghadi information is just that there are these two guest houses in Tehran, but he never puts the petitioner in them? It's only the al-Jadani statement.
But al-Jadani
saying that his conversation with petitioner admitted he was in.
Absolutely, Your Honor. But we start with the predicate that we have from a high-level al-Qaeda official that we have these guest houses, which, like this court has said, you wouldn't expect to find non-al-Qaeda people. You're not going to find non-al-Qaeda people.
That's a follow-up issue on what Judge Rogers is saying. That's a different point.
So we have what ties them.
As to Al Jadani's statements about petitioner, right. And again, the district court says it could be the wrong person.
Right, and Obama says he can't be certain, and he provides no legitimate basis for that other than his own speculation in his opinion that while there Hussein's a common name, there are a lot of people from Aden. There was never any information suggesting that there was another Hussein from Aden at Guantanamo. Of course, if we had information, we would have had to give it to the defense. They would have argued that. This was total, made-up speculation by the district court in his opinion, and it doesn't hold water. It's just a complete red herring. And also, the information being related by Al Jadani.
Does that mean you're challenging his factual finding?
Absolutely, we're challenging.
Well, why didn't you say it in your brief?
We said the findings were flawed. We say that.
You say clearly erroneous. That's the magic language.
We're not arguing that the facts here are such that that they were so clearly erroneous that requires, as in Al-Adahi or in Uthman, ultimate reversal in our favor, and that the evidence can only come out one way. But certainly, the approach here to that evidence,
the evidence here, in your view, can only come out one way? I've been listening to you for 15 minutes.
We think the evidence is overwhelming in our support, but the district court has a fact-finding role here.
I don't understand it, counsel. You have 6 or 7 pieces of evidence, right? Is that correct?
Even more, yes.
Oh, okay. At least 8 more than you want. 8 pieces of evidence, all of which you regard as probative, greater or lesser strength, but all probative. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
On the other side of the balance, we're talking about preponderance of the evidence. On the other side of the balance, the petitioner has 1 piece of evidence, his statement, right? Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And you believe that statement is actually evidence on your side because it's palpably false?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Then I don't understand what's left in this case.
We are not going to...
If you have 8 pieces of evidence or 9 pieces of evidence on one side and 0 on the other, how can you not have preponderance of the evidence as a matter of law?
We certainly believe we have more than a preponderance of evidence, even...
As a matter of law.
I'm not going to fight the suggestion that if you agree with that.
But what I'm puzzled about is why aren't you making that argument? Are you making that argument but not making the argument? So I don't quite understand where you are.
I think
when you said to me, well, it could be, it goes back to the district judge and he could come out a different way. I'm mystified because I don't see how he can.
The key evidence, as Judge Kavanaugh Roger says, is Jadani's conversation at Guantanamo with the petitioner. The district court dismissed it on a basis which doesn't hold water. On remand, the district court may have another reason. I don't think there are any other reasons, but I think
review a case from the district court on a question of preponderance of the evidence and send it back on remand, say, well, you rejected this bit of evidence, we think that's wrong, but you might have some other ground. We never do that.
Maybe we were unduly conservative in that, Your Honor, but that was our approach to the case, is that the reason he gave didn't hold up. All the evidence here works together to show that support the government's narrative, and that the district court has to explain why that evidence all fitting together isn't enough to support detention and to factor in the false cover stories.
This may be a strange comment, but I think what's happening here is the district judges and you are looking at this case as if it's, although we talk about preponderance of evidence, you look at it as if it was beyond a reasonable doubt. And it's very strange.
We certainly are, that is not our intent, and you see our argument here is that the evidence here from his story doesn't just add, if you from the district court's opinion, it's just all coincidence. He just happens to be in Tehran, happens to go to Mashhad, and certainly we think there's a strong, compelling case in our favor here, which requires...
I'm reminded of the language in Hamdi, in which the Supreme Court talked about shifting of burdens. The goal would be in ensuring that the errant tourist, the embedded journalist, or local aid worker has a chance to prove military error when he or she is picked up as a detainee. Right. We've gone a long way from that.
No, Your Honor, we still have a burden to prove that he is part of Al-Qaeda here. The Supreme Court said he needs to have a meaningful hearing. The detainees are getting meaningful hearings with the preponderance evidence review.
I grant you. There's no question about that. You're getting meaningful hearing. But what I'm puzzled about is how you're using preponderance of the evidence.
Counsel, why don't we hear from counsel for petitioner, and we'll give you a few minutes on rebuttal.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
May it please the court. I'm Bill Livingston. I represent petitioner Hussein Salem Mohammed Al-Murfidi. Counsel likened this case to the recent decision by Judge Kavanaugh in the Uthman case. This case bears no resemblance to that. This court found that Uthman was captured near Tora Bora at the time of the Battle of Tora Bora, that he had attended a school in Yemen where extremists went to school, that he had taken a route to Afghanistan that was the route that jihadists took, and similar type findings, that he was captured with bodyguards.
Yeah, but this counsel,
this is not this case. In this case, petitioner was captured not in Pakistan or Afghanistan. He was arrested by the Iranian police on the streets of Iran, not by the United States or its coalition partners, but by the Iranians. And the Iranians took him to a jail and they beat him. And they accused him of being an American spy. That's how this story begins. He stays there for 2 months in Iranian jails. And then the Iranians gather him and nine other people who are languishing in Iranian jails from various countries, Uzbekistan, Tunisia, Algeria, and ships them in something called a prisoner exchange to Afghanistan. We know virtually nothing about that. We don't know what the Iranians got in return, but that's how this case got started. Al-Murfidi then goes to a prison in Afghanistan for a year where nothing happens, and then to Cuba where nothing happens. That's how this case starts. It bears no resemblance to the cases that have been decided against petitioners in this court. There is no claim here of that anything the judge did was clearly erroneous, and the judge, this is an experienced district judge. Judge Friedman applied the preponderance standard. There's no reason to doubt his word when he says, I looked at the evidence as a whole, I looked at it carefully. It's clear from the face of the opinion that he considered the circumstantial evidence, the various arguments that are being made about money and the like, and he weighed all of these factors. And what did he find? He found that the only direct evidence that the government relied on that linked Al-Murfidi to Al-Qaeda was inherently unreliable and not credible, and that the theory that the government is pursuing, that Al-Murfidi was an Al-Qaeda facilitator operating out of a guest house in Tehran, was itself implausible.
Is it your view that the district judge ruled as a matter of fact that all of the evidence put in by the government to establish its burden of preponderance of the evidence, all of the evidence was invalid?
No. He did not exclude any evidence. He looked at all of it. He gave it such weight.
What was his judgment about the evidence?
Well,
did he conclude that it was probative or not probative?
Let me address it this way.
Please answer the question, yes or no.
He found that the only direct evidence they had...
Did he conclude the evidence was probative or not probative?
He found that they didn't carry their burden of proof.
I'm still trying to determine. Is there evidence that was put in by the government that he's decided was not probative?
There was evidence that the government put in that he said was inherently unreliable and could
not
be credited.
Not probative.
Well, he didn't use that term, so I'm hesitant to put those words in.
Is there any evidence he concluded was probative?
He didn't use that term, so I don't want to put words in his mouth. He analyzed all the evidence.
Isn't that necessary to determine whether the government met its burden of preponderance of the evidence? You have to ask, did they produce probative evidence?
He obviously looked at all the evidence to see whether it proved the case, whether it was probative of the case. And he explains that in great detail.
Well, hypothetically, if there's five pieces of evidence that are probative for the government, and there is no piece of evidence that is probative for your client, that's the end of the case, isn't it?
That's not this case.
No, hypothetically, that would be true, wouldn't it?
It depends on what those five pieces are.
No, if there are five probative pieces.
If there are five sufficient to establish a preponderance of the evidence in a hypothetical case, then that would, then he would have come out that way. But that's not this case.
Well, what did he do?
He looked at all of the evidence. He carefully evaluated it. Let me, if I could, I'd like to discuss some of the evidence. The only direct evidence linking Al-Mufidi to Al-Qaeda, the only evidence, are statements by another detainee at Guantanamo, Al-Jadani, number 230. He is the only source that links Al-Mufidi to Al-Qaeda.
That's true even in criminal cases sometimes, beyond a reasonable doubt standard, where people are put away for a long time.
And that's why this was his statements were the heart of the case. That's why the judge's opinion.
I agree with you that his statements are key to the case.
And the judge focused on them like a laser beam. And what do we know about 230? We know that what he was telling the interrogator was not something he had learned in Iran. He'd never been to Iran. It was not something he knew because he had known Al-Mufidi prior to capture. He hadn't known Al-Mufidi. He was telling the interrogator things that he said he had learned while at Guantanamo in 2005 and 2006, 4 to 5 years after Al-Mufidi had been captured and was languishing in prison. That's when this evidence arises. That's when 230 claims to have learned.
But he's learning it from
Al-Mufidi. What's he learning? He has two sources. In 2005, he tells his interrogator that an unnamed group of detainees had come to Guantanamo in late 2004 and had indicated that somebody named Hussein al-Adeni, which means Hussein from the city of Aden.
And he's the only one, right?
They don't say Hussein al-Adeni who's in Guantanamo. They just say Hussein al-Adeni. That's what the interrogation reports say. A later summary, and somebody's interpolated to say, this man's in Camp 1. He may be the only one, but the interrogation reports just say Hussein al-Adeni. We don't even know if that's the right man. That's no more than saying John from Richmond, Virginia. But put that to one
side. Let me ask you a question. If this were a jury case, would you say that evidence would be excluded from the jury?
Oh, absolutely. To have somebody come in and say, I was in a jailhouse and there was a group of people who I don't name and who I don't even claim to have talked to, and I have no idea what their source of information is, and they say that some other prisoner was a facilitator for Al-Qaeda, of course it would be excluded.
What about the statements from Al-Mufidi?
It's jailhouse gossip at the very best.
What about the statements from Al-Mufidi to Al-Jadani?
Let me get to those first.
Are very probative.
Well, let me get to those. But first, let me just wrap up on the jailhouse gossip from the unnamed group. The unnamed group also said that he was in Tehran in late 2000, early 2001. That's the dates they put in there, which would have been impossible. He was in Yemen then. He didn't leave Yemen until September 2001. But now let me focus on the alleged statements that in 2006, 5 years after the capture, Jadani says, I spoke with Al-Mufidi in the prison. There's some question about the names, but just I'll grant for sake of argument that he spoke to Al-Mufidi. And he claims that Al-Mufidi told him the following story, that Al-Mufidi said, I was in guest houses in Iran in 2002 and 2003. And in 2002 and 2003, according to Jadani, Al-Mufidi said, Iranian intelligence operatives came to the guest house, took photographs of us, gave us false passports, and proposed an escape plan. Well, this whole story is just preposterous and impossible. Preposterous because the Iranian intelligence didn't help Al-Mufidi escape. They arrested him, and they beat him, and they accused him of being a U.S. spy. And it's impossible because in 2002 and 2003, Al-Mufidi was in jail, first in Iran, then in American custody for almost all of 2002, in Afghanistan, and then in Cuba for most of 2003. So he's got a pretty good alibi. You ask him, but does he have six or seven pieces of evidence. That's some pretty good evidence that Al-Jadani's statement is unreliable.
All right, let me go on and ask one more question. I'm still trying to think of it doctrinally. Let us suppose the district judge concludes that all of the government's evidence is dubious. I'm not prepared to say that any of it is probative, except for the story that the petitioner has advanced, which I regard as absurd and non-credible. Isn't it correct that under those circumstances, the district judge would say, properly, the government has met its burden of preponderance of the evidence?
As a matter of law, I don't think that's correct.
Under our ACCA case, it is under Title VII. Why isn't it adequate here?
I think in a criminal case, you can't prove your
case. You're not in a criminal case. You're in a civil case.
Well, I don't know the employment laws. I don't know the answer to that, but I don't think the government's...
You're in a civil case, though.
In this case...
See, that's what I'm worried about. I think the notion that you're in a criminal case pervades some of the district judge's considerations. But in a civil case, the only bit of evidence that you're prepared as district judge to admit as probative is the story of the petitioner, which you regard as a lie. And therefore, you use that as evidence against the petitioner.
I understand what you're saying, Your Honor, but if
that's the only evidence in the case.
If that were the only evidence in the case, there would be no case. If you didn't have...
Why isn't there evidence? Well, wait a minute. Why is that not a preponderance of the evidence, then?
Because it's not evidence of linking him to Al-Qaeda. If there's no evidence linking him to Al-Qaeda, that's the end of the case.
Well, if he lies about circumstances which lead you to conclude that he, the only reason for the lie is he is linked to Al-Qaeda, why isn't that enough evidence?
I want to get to that issue because I don't think he lied, and I think the
I understand. I'm just talking about doctrinally why that isn't true.
But
isn't that doctrinally?
I think as a theoretical matter, and we haven't briefed that, it's not this case, he didn't lie, but as a theoretical matter, the government can't meet its burden unless it's got some reliable evidence linking the detainee to Al-Qaeda or the Taliban.
All right.
There's no such evidence in this case.
Let me ask you, though. The government, you're focusing on direct evidence. The government can rely on circumstantial evidence.
Yes.
So here, as I understand it, your client says he's going to Europe. He goes with Mr. Ali. He goes to eventually gets to Tehran, and instead of going east, he goes west, 500 miles to Mashhad, which happens to be this, what did counsel call it, station point where troops go into Afghanistan. There's no explanation as to why he's in Mashhad.
Well, there is an explanation. And let me, if I could, put that explanation in the context of his story. They call it his cover story, but it's his story. And there's nothing implausible about it. His story is a very familiar story. It's the story of a young man from an utterly impoverished third world country who suffers oppression and discrimination because he's a South Yemeni, and he wants to travel to Europe, just like people try to get to the United States from the various countries in the world. And they take great risks in doing so, and they put themselves in the hands of smugglers and take other great risks to get to the land of opportunity. That's the story here.
So there's no evidence that smugglers would take people to Mashhad to get to Europe.
The evidence on Mashhad is that when they enter Iran, they go almost immediately to Mashhad, which is in the east of the country. And he says that the smuggler had a house there. The smuggler parks him there for a month. We don't know why. He doesn't know why. The smuggler doesn't get arrested. Nobody has any idea where he is. But he's totally in the control of the smuggler. Just as somebody leaving a village in Guatemala in the hands of a smuggler may end up in a van in the Arizona desert, you follow the smuggler. He goes into Iran, he's told, I'm going to take you to Turkey and then to Greece. But the smuggler says, first, I'm going to take you to my house in Mashhad, and we're going to wait there for a while. He has no way to buck that. He doesn't speak Farsi. He can't interject himself into Iran. He has to follow the smugglers. He said in his CS, in his ARB proceeding, when he was asked, how are you going to travel? He says, I go with smuggler. I go with smuggler. If he walks, I walk. If he drives, I drive. That's why he's in Mashhad. Why the smuggler took him to Mashhad and why he parked him there for a month, I don't have an answer for that. And maybe there isn't any good answer. And one can only speculate. But we do know that there's not a shred of evidence that he did anything in Mashhad that had anything to do with al-Qaeda, that he associated with anyone in Mashhad that had any relationship with al-Qaeda, that he did any facilitating or trafficking or anything. There's not a shred of evidence that he did anything that was there that was untoward. Now, go back to when he was in Yemen, and he's got this dream, and that's how he puts it, I have a dream of going to Europe. He starts saving money as early as 1994. He lives at home so he can save money. The government says, how did he come up with $2,000? That's a lot of money for a poor country. It's not a lot of money for $2,000 is not a lot of money.
Now, the story was that he had the money and then he supposedly spent a lot along the way, according to his own story, but still when captured, still had $2,000. That's their story.
Well, some of the expenditures were made while he was still in Yemen, like the airplane ticket to Pakistan and the visa. And he didn't include those when he said how much money he had. And there are various amounts stated in the various documents, $2,000, $1,600. Some of the amounts are stated in Pakistani rupees or Yemeni rials. And you can find various numbers. They're all in the same range. Surely that's a trivial difference on which to say, oh, well, he must be al-Qaeda. Anybody who would say in one interview in 2003 that he had $2,000 and then 3 years later in an interview he said he had $2,500, ha-ha, we can make something out of that. You can't. That's constructing a house of straw. What's missing in this case is evidence of the linkage to al-Qaeda. But let me get back to the story of the immigrant. He saves his money. Now, he can't just go to Europe from Yemen and move in. That's not an option that's available to him. He can't get a visa to go to France or Germany. But he has a plan that he'll go to Pakistan and try to hook up with a well-established missionary group in Lahore. And that's what he does. And he goes there and he meets a man named Ali, who he trusts, who speaks different languages and seems to be a man of the world. And Ali says, that's a good plan. But 9/11 had just then occurred, and travel was disrupted. And there weren't any mission groups going to Europe. Travel even in this country was disrupted after 9/11. The airports were shut. But this was even worse, because the chance of Muslim missionary groups going to Europe after 9/11 was became impossible.
This group's also a terrorist support group.
That's the evidence of the record is that it is a well-established, long-established, legitimate missionary organization in which al-Qaeda...
I take your point, but there's also evidence in the record suggesting that the group has at least some people involved in the group are engaged in terrorist activities or support of terrorist activities.
There's some thin evidence of that. I think they cite a report based on Asian internet sites where they get that information. But be that as it may, this is a group with millions of adherents, literally millions. And there's no question.
You cannot deny that that would be probative evidence. It's true that some people connected to this organization are perfectly innocent, others are not. But it's certainly probative evidence as an indication of the likelihood of the petitioner.
Absolutely not.
It's not probative evidence at all.
No. There's no claim that he was a member of the organization, that he was a supporter of the organization. No claim of that. There's no claim that while he was in Lahore for 2.5 months that he ever associated with anybody that had anything to do with al-Qaeda, that he ever did anything that was related to al-Qaeda. Not one piece of evidence, not even a claim. There's no evidence of that. There's no more basis for saying...
What was he doing there for 2.5 months?
He was waiting, because 9/11 had frustrated travel. Ali said, wait, things will get better. So he waits. He waits a day, he waits a week, the time goes on. He hasn't given up his dream of going to Europe. He doesn't want to go back to Yemen. He wants to pursue the dream. Ali tells him to wait. And then
The district court called that stay strange and unexplained.
That's right. Yeah. That's, and took that into account in assessing the evidence and still finding in our favor. After that period, at some point Ali comes to him and says, because of the war in Afghanistan, the Pakistanis are arresting Arabs and turning them over to the United States. And the court knows that's true. You've seen cases where that's true. It was true in the Uthman case, where Uthman was arrested by the Pakistanis. And so Ali says, you've got two choices. You can go back to Yemen, or I can smuggle you overland from Pakistan directly into Iran, to Turkey, to Greece. And he goes with that plan, because he hasn't abandoned the dream, and he puts his fate in the hands of this smuggler. But nothing he did while during the 2.5 months in Lahore had any relationship or any claimed relationship with Al-Qaeda. This is not a story. This is an immigrant story. Many immigrants over the decades, centuries in this country have stories that are at least as bizarre and as difficult and as gripping, and sometimes the immigrants come to bad ends. But this is not the story of a person who is working in Tehran guest houses as a facilitator moving troops in and out of Afghanistan. And that's what their theory is. That's the entire theory of the case, that this man was really in Tehran guest houses facilitating the travel of fighters. In fact, this fact that he was in Lahore and Mashhad is totally inconsistent with their theory. He leaves Yemen in September of 01. A DOD report says he was captured in December of 01, about 3.5 months, which is about the time he was spending in Lahore and Mashhad. He was in Tehran for at most a day or two or three before he was arrested. He was never in Tehran. They've wrestled with that problem in this case. They've never had a timeline in this case that makes any sense, that supports their theory. So now they say, well, maybe he wasn't arrested in December. Maybe he wasn't arrested till February. There's no real evidence for that. The DOD report says September. Maybe it was January. But that's hardly enough time to be an Al-Qaeda facilitator, especially the one Jadani said was there in 2003 and 2002. And even as late as the reply brief in this case, on the last page of the reply brief in this case, next to the last page, they argue, realizing they have this timeline problem, well, maybe he really wasn't in Pakistan for 2.5 months. Maybe he snuck out and went to Tehran without us knowing about it. So maybe he really was in Tehran during all or part of that period. There's no evidence for that. That's just maybe. But they've got a burden of proof, not a burden of maybe. And they wouldn't be making arguments like that on the last page of their reply brief if they really had a case, if they really had evidence. But they don't. They just have maybe. The judge found, when you want to look at the plausibility of stories, look at the government story. They say this man operated out of Tehran guest houses, moving troops in and out. Maybe even went to Mashhad, moved troops in and out. No evidence of that. They can put him in Mashhad, but they can't put him in Mashhad at a guest house or doing anything. But what's the basis for saying that? From his time in Yemen, there's no evidence that he had ever associated with anyone related to Al-Qaeda or to extremism or jihadism or anything of that nature. The evidence is that while he was in Yemen, he lived with his family and he worked like a dog to make enough money so that he could go to Europe. That's all he did in Yemen. There's no evidence he's not an educated man. There's no evidence that he had any training in the logistics of travel or moving soldiers around or managing funds that would be needed or buying airplane tickets or using modern communications equipment, all the kinds of things you would need if you really were an Al-Qaeda facilitator. And if it really...
A lot of what you're saying, I think, is forceful, but the Al-Jadani statements put all that activity arguably in a different light. And it seems to me that the district court said that it wasn't going to consider that because it couldn't be certain, that's the district court's words, certain word, that it was the same person. And I'm not sure certainty is the right standard there for looking at whether the Jadani statement is describing something that was said by petitioner here.
Then if
the Jadani statements come in, then all of what you've described, which I understand when you look at it without it, takes on a whole different look, doesn't it?
The Jadani statements are in. Everything was in evidence. Nothing was kept
out. I meant counted as referring to petitioner here as opposed to potentially referring to someone else. The district court saying that he had to be certain.
I think that's a misreading of the opinion. The opinion says...
Well, he uses the word certain.
He says, I can't be certain that the references to Hussein al-Adeni, a report that simply refers to Hussein al-Adeni, is a reference to al-Mufidi. But he says, I'm not going to discount that entirely. The initial reports, the ones from the unnamed source of detainees who came to Gitmo in 2004, which Jadani passes on in 2005, the unnamed group of detainees simply refer to somebody named Hussein al-Adeni, and I think it's perfectly appropriate. They don't say Hussein al-Adeni who's here in Gitmo. They say Hussein al-Adeni. That could have been John Smith.
Again,
I'm willing to grant...
Again, are you asserting that is not probative, therefore?
It's a factor to take into account in analyzing the evidence, but he found the Jadani evidence unreliable on other grounds, because it was jailhouse gossip in one case, because the story had all the dates and the facts wrong, that when he purports to be reciting what he'd heard in jailhouse conversations with al-Mufidi, the story that Jadani tells has al-Mufidi in Iran only in 2002, 2003, and has him dealing with Iranian intelligence operatives, preposterous, impossible stories, not to be relied on. There's one other factor on the government's argument. If true that he really were a facilitator, then hundreds of people would have known about it, maybe thousands. The United States has detained over the years thousands of men in Afghanistan and in Guantanamo. Apparently not a single one has ever said, the man who facilitated my travel was al-Mufidi, or I went through it. Not one witness.
Can I interrupt? Sure. I saw something to that effect in the district court's opinion, and that troubled me a bit, to assume that just because there are a lot of witnesses out there that necessarily there would be a lot of testimony from people. It's not necessarily the habit of al-Qaeda detainees to start necessarily labeling everyone else who was involved with them. Some of them do, right? That's part of what the executive branch says the mission is to get them to talk, but a lot do not. So just because there are hundreds of people who knew something doesn't mean you would have hundreds of pieces of evidence of witness statements, correct?
I've been involved in a great number of these cases. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you that these detainees are interrogated time after time, year after year. And they do say, they tell who facilitated their travel, who they traveled with, where they went to school. It's not at all uncommon. Jadani himself, in this case, gives such information. And it is surprising. It's astonishing that if there were any truth to this case, there isn't at least one, just one person who could say
there is one.
No, not Jadani, because he wasn't in Iran. Jadani,
he said he heard it directly from petitioner's mouth
in 2006. That's
right. No,
but he has no person. He wasn't there.
That's important. That's important evidence. There are other reasons not to maybe credit it, and you and the district court both identified some, but that's highly significant evidence.
He said he was there in 2003 and 2002. He said he came to Guantanamo in 2002. al-Mufidi didn't come to Guantanamo in 2002. He came to Guantanamo in 2003. Now, I don't know what was going on with 230, whether he was making these stories up. We do know he's been released shortly after these statements. He was sent back to Saudi Arabia. We, of course, never had a chance to talk to him. We do know other cases that are in the press where detainees have been released who've later said, when I was in Guantanamo, I told lies. And maybe that happened here. Maybe he was telling the interrogator just whatever he wanted, or maybe he was making things up or garbling things. We also have evidence in this record that the interrogator was not competent. The interrogator was a contract employee of the DOD who had formerly worked for the DOD, who lived in, I think, someplace in Central America, and had come to Guantanamo when they were hiring up people to do these interrogations when they had all these prisoners. You read her reports and you compare them to the FBI types of reports, and the comparison is startling, and there's every reason to think that her reports aren't reliable. We've covered some of that in the brief. But there are lots of reasons why 230 could have gotten this wrong. I think the most probable is he was just making up stories to tell his interrogator. But the story he tells, that Al-Murfidi was in Tehran in 2003, 2002, that's impossible. He's being accused of a crime he couldn't have committed.
The date could be wrong. That's the
key. Well, if the date can be wrong, it can all be wrong.
The key, right, I get that. But I think the key fact from the story was that petitioner told Jadani that he was at an Al-Qaeda guest house in Tehran. That is the key fact. Now, there are reasons that may not be credible, but that's what we have.
And you're incorrect in asserting that he's been accused of a crime.
Well, he's been in jail for a very long time. He's been in Iranian jails.
He's not a criminal proceeding.
I think I've covered the points I want to cover.
All right.
He has been in jail a long time. I implore the court, the district judge here, Judge Friedman, is a highly experienced judge. He knows, he applied the correct standards. He knows what a preponderance standard is. He carefully evaluated all of the evidence and we had a three-day hearing. You read the transcript, you'll see he's asking questions. It's clear from the opinion. He looked at everything very carefully. He weighed it very carefully. They say, no clear error. They just want a remand. They even said today, this case could go either way, that it's possible that we're allowed to win because it's up to the fact finder that this is, if this were a jury case, the jury couldn't be overruled. Or if it were the NFL, the official on the field couldn't be overruled because unless it was clear error, and there is no clear error. He applied the correct standard. If this is a case where the district judge, as fact finder, clearly has to be affirmed. There is nothing wrong in the process.
On your point about detention for a long time, I'll repeat something I've said before, which is whether the standard should be higher after 10 years, 20 years, 30 years is something one thinks about in these cases, but I'm not sure that the courts can do that on their own. It seems to me that the standard probably has to be the same at day one as it is as we go along for the courts. Certainly Congress or the executive branch can devise review procedures that have a heightened standard over time, but for us, I think we have to look at it as someone detained 2005, 2006, 2007, and the standard doesn't change for us.
I'm not going to agree with that. I think, first of all, the evidence they rely on here all came into the possession of the government in 2005, 2006, after he'd been in jail for 4 years. So presumably they would concede now that they had no basis for holding him between 2001 and 2005.
I was just making a comment that the length of the detention is of concern to us as well, but I'm not sure it can alter the standard under the law.
Justice O'Connor indicated that there is a limit. She didn't say what the limit is,
Hamdi did say contemplated detention for the duration of the hostilities and contemplated that that could be indefinite.
All right, thank you, counsel. Counsel for appellant here.
Thank you. I just want to make a couple of quick points. One about the key SIR issue, which is Jadani's conversation with the petitioner here, which is at 303. First of all, even petitioner's counsel here as well, the district court didn't discount it altogether, suggested it might not be petitioner, and that, but then there's no other actual reason given by the district court for discounting it. Moreover, it doesn't just tie him to this guest house. It relates to all the other evidence. It talks about that he informed Jadani about the two bin Laden guest house in Tehran, one being a high-level house, one being more for more junior individuals, matching up to the other statements from al-Ghadi, and that bin Laden funded both houses. The dates of the SIR are correct. He says 4 years earlier, that's exactly the period he was there and the period he was captured. The suggestion he's making this up, he's making up that he just so happens he was in Tehran, so happens he was captured by the Iranian government when Jadani says so, just so happens he was transferred to Afghanistan, just so happens he was then transferred to the U.S., all in the same timeline that matches up to reality. This guy must have some imagination. In fact, the district court just didn't take into account how all these facts relate to the other pieces of evidence. This is the most damning piece of evidence, but it doesn't stand alone. It ties everything together. Petitioner's counsel tells a compelling story of a young man trying to find himself, going to Europe. The trouble is the district court didn't credit that story. The district court, instead, at every stage of it, doubted it. The story about Ali, that he was the only Arab speaker in Pakistan in this JT group, the petitioner had to change his story about that in midstream. That the JT group, you could stay with this radicalizing group for 2.5 weeks and do 2.5 months and do nothing and they'd not be subject to their some of the elements there. The district court found strange and unexplained. Of course, again, he explained it. The district court didn't credit it. The money, the district court doesn't make a ruling on, but it just doesn't add up. And finally, Mashad, he says, well, he just stayed there, he didn't do nothing. The district court didn't believe that. The district court found that to be perplexing and strange at best. So this case cannot be affirmed on the basis of his story being credited by the district court. The district court did not do so.
All right. Thank you. We'll take the case under advisement.
And there's no need for us to have, in our view, a closed session.
All right. Thank you.
I disagree. I do have some points I'd like to talk about in closed session. They're very few in number.
All right.
I wasn't able to say.
All right. Well, why don't we take a brief recess?